we needed to do was lay the groundwork within the society itself by talking to people, whether they be religious groups or civic organizations such as Rotary Clubs and Chambers of Commerce, people at county fairs, about the issue of same-sex marriage. But more generally, we would talk to people about the reality of gay and lesbian lives.
Sandy went to the doctor, and he told her that she had cancer. And she came back home, and she wanted me to talk to the doctor, too. He absolutely refused to discuss anything with me because I wasn't family. Now, we'd only been together about 30 years at the time.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. It's apparently smooth sailing for the British Navy's out service members, the continuing Boy Scouts controversy becomes presidential campaign fodder, and the long journey to Vermont civil unions and the road yet ahead. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jay Schulte.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 2nd, 2000. Allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly in Britain's Royal Navy has not caused any great difficulty, the Navy's head of personnel policy said this week. Admiral James Burnell Nugent, who as Assistant Chief of Navy Staff is number two in the hierarchy, said it had actually been less trouble to lift the long-standing ban on gay and lesbian service than it had been to allow women to go to sea 10 years ago. Burnell Nugent said that although not everyone was happy with the policy change, on the whole, it has not caused a great upset among the services. He added that, if we want to be in an armed force that preserves democracy at home and promotes it around the world, then part of that is to be signed up to democratic principles ourselves. Britain switched to a gender-neutral policy on service members' relationships in January, following a European Court of Human Rights ruling in September.
But gays still can't wear the uniform of the Boy Scouts of America, and there was political uproar this week when conservatives learned that the U.S. Department of the Interior was reviewing its ties with the Scouts for compliance with a presidential order against discrimination. The executive order issued in June prohibits sexual orientation discrimination in federal education and training programs. The Department of the Interior was the first government agency to seek guidance from the Department of Justice regarding an organization's compliance with the order, and the Department of Justice is still in the process of developing guidelines. But conservatives took the review process as an attack on the Scouts and quickly made it a campaign issue. Republican presidential nominee Texas Governor George W. Bush said he was troubled at the suggestion that the Clinton-Gore administration might sever the federal government's longstanding relationship with the Boy Scouts of America. Campaign aides to Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Al Gore responded that should he be elected, the Scouts would be able to use federal land. Before the Department of the Interior had even submitted the materials it was gathering for the review, Attorney General Janet Reno announced her ruling that the Scouts' activities were not, in fact, federal education and training programs, and therefore were exempt from the executive order.
Concerns about child prostitution and sex tourism led police in Thailand to raid a British businessman's birthday party in Bangkok this week. Police found about 100 foreigners and almost 30 young Thais in various stages of undress at the colony sauna, but no illegal activity. After taking many of the guests in for questioning, they charged the club's manager and the man whose birthday it was and released them on bail. While the police told reporters that the Thais ranged in age from 10 to 16 years, the Briton insisted that none were under 18. He says he was charged with organizing an immoral sex party because his name was on the cake, but that actually friends had set up the party to surprise him. Another party guest believed that the children's rights activist who called in the police and camera crews had herself been tipped off by a local gay who was miffed at not being invited. Just 10 days before, police had raided a gay party at a bar in Salam, arresting a Frenchman and more than 20 young Thais.
A child who attended kindergarten as a boy but tried to enroll in first grade as a girl has been removed from her home by child welfare authorities in Ohio. The 6-year-old has insisted that she's female since she was 2 and was formally diagnosed with gender identity disorder by the Cincinnati Children's Medical Center in November. Officials seem to question the diagnosis, but the parents accept their child's female identity, and their attorney believes that recognition and understanding of it has improved life for the whole family. The parents will attempt to regain custody at a court hearing in mid-September.
One trans woman's legal defeat in Texas is leading to another's victory over the state's ban on same-gender marriages. In the notorious case of trans woman Christy Littleton, a state appeals court had decided that chromosomes rather than genitalia determine sex, voiding Littleton's 7-year marriage to a man and denying her status to sue for medical malpractice in his death. The Texas Supreme Court declined to review that ruling, and the U.S. Supreme Court will decide this month whether to take it up. Meanwhile, Littleton's attorney, transsexual activist Phyllis Fry, is encouraging Texas transsexuals in gay and lesbian relationships to marry, reasoning that if they can't legally marry someone of their birth gender, then they can marry someone of their surgically reassigned gender. The first couple to take the plunge are trans woman Jessica Wicks and her female partner Robin Manhart Wicks, who'll be getting a marriage license in Bexar County this coming week. In practice, and even in Littleton's case, Texas does not examine marriage license applicants' chromosomes or genitalia, but only their driver's licenses or birth certificates.
Ireland is also in a muddle about a transsexual's marriage, discovering it has no relevant legislation. Russian trans man Nicholas Krivenko last year married his longtime German female partner in Limerick, and this year applied for legal residence in Ireland based on that marriage to a citizen of a European Union member nation. Normally, the marriage would qualify him for residency because Ireland is also an EU member. But Ireland's Department of Justice has not granted it because of what it called serious concerns regarding the legality of his Irish marriage. Krivenko's attorney is determined to take the matter to court one way or another if his residency is not granted, and that legal case will be the nation's first of its kind. At least one politician has called on the Irish Parliament to update and reform family law to respond to such situations rather than leaving it up to the courts.
A gay male couple in Montreal has filed a lawsuit claiming that Quebec's law against same-gender marriages is unconstitutional. Michael Hendricks and Renee Leboeuf have been a couple for 27 years. They applied to register a civil marriage first in 1998 and again in July of this year and were rejected. Their attorney believes Quebec's law exceeds the province's jurisdiction and violates both provincial and Canadian laws against discrimination. Their lawsuit is particularly significant in Quebec because although gay and lesbian couples are legally entitled to the same recognition as unmarried heterosexual couples, unmarrieds have very little legal recognition in this province.
Israeli gay and lesbian activists were bitterly disappointed this week to discover that one of their political allies had drafted a bill to create civil marriages without including them. Israel does not have civil marriage for heterosexuals, although it recognizes those marriages when performed in other countries. Justice Minister Yossi Beilin called his bill a revolution that he thinks has a chance of passage. But he called legal recognition of same-gender couples a second revolution that he did not want to endanger the first. Beilin did indicate he would support recognition of gay and lesbian couples in the future. Openly lesbian Tel Aviv City Councilor Michal Eden said after meeting with Beilin this week that, "I find it strange that a bill intended to correct the injustice caused to so many sectors of the public excludes homosexuals and lesbians and thus perpetuates the existing discrimination. It is even more disappointing that Yossi Beilin, known for his contribution to equality in Israeli society and for his fight for human rights, is responsible for this bill."
A call for legal recognition of same-gender couples was issued in the UK this week by Stephen Norris, the failed candidate for London mayor, who has now been named vice chair of the National Conservative Party. He condemned his own party colleagues for what he called a polite form of racism and homophobia, and said they must learn to be more inclusive to succeed as a national party. Long a champion of equal treatment of gays and lesbians, Norris declared this week that he saw no moral barrier to giving same-gender couples the same inheritance rights and tax breaks as married couples. But the Conservative Party has vigorously opposed gay-friendly law reform in the Parliament, and parliamentary leader William Hague was quick to say he disagreed with Norris's proposal. But Hague added that it was part of Norris's new job to change the public perception of the party as homophobic. A Labor Party spokesperson said Norris should not allow himself to be used as a liberal fig leaf for a Conservative Party that is more extreme than ever.
And finally, one more item about marriage proposals. Lots and lots of them have been coming to American Richard Hatch. As the million-dollar winner of the TV show Survivor, he's now one of the most famous openly gay men in the world. But the marriage proposals have been coming to Hatch from both men and women. He said, "I don't know what those women are thinking."
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 2nd, 2000. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Chase Schulte.
The celebration of the first civil unions in July was far from the end of the marriage rights story in Vermont. As election season heats up, the backlash against enactment of the law to extend the benefits of marriage to same-gender couples has become a key campaign issue. Especially in rural areas, conservatives vowing to take back Vermont are registering to vote in record numbers, intent on removing legislators who passed the measure. But activists who put years of effort into raising consciousness about lesbian and gay issues have been hoping that the long process would lay a strong enough foundation to resist such a backlash. Reporter Elaine Clift talks about the past, present, and the future for same-gender couples in Vermont with some of the people who worked on that foundation to successfully make civil unions a reality.
People here in this rural Green Mountain state of only 600,000 like to say that their motto is live and let live. They pride themselves on their reputation for innovation and liberalism. Still, civil union for same-sex couples did not come easily. It began in 1995 when attorneys Susan Murray, Beth Robinson, and others organized the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force, and it culminated in December of 1999 when the state Supreme Court granted the same rights and privileges of married couples to gays and lesbians. The Vermont legislature then determined that civil union and not marriage would constitute the legal entity under which such commitments would be recognized. Robinson and Murray argued the case that came to be known as Baker versus Vermont in November of 1998.
My name is Susan Murray, and I'm an attorney with Lang, Roxbury & Woolen in Middlebury, Vermont, and I'm one of the co-counsel in the Baker versus State same-sex marriage case. We argued that denial of a marriage license to our clients, who were three same-sex couples, two lesbian couples, and one gay male couple, was a violation of the Vermont Constitution, the Common Benefits Clause of the Vermont Constitution, which is similar but not identical to the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. We were very aware of the fact that it was not just a legal case, that we could not operate this case in a vacuum. In fact, I, along with Beth Robinson, who is one of my law partners here, co-founded a grassroots organization called the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force several years before we took the lawsuit on, with the idea that what we needed to do was lay the groundwork within the society itself by talking to people, whether they be religious groups or civic organizations such as Rotary Clubs and Chambers of Commerce. We would go to county fairs and talk to people at county fairs about the issue of same-sex marriage, but more generally, we would talk to people about the reality of gay and lesbian lives and the fact that there are gay and lesbian couples in Vermont and that many of them are raising children and that those children do not have the kinds of supports and protections that they need legally. They don't have the security that other children have because their parents don't have any legal relationship to one another. So we did a lot of the grassroots organizing before we ever took on the legal case. The case was argued at the Vermont Supreme Court in November of 1998. My co-counsel, Beth Robinson, actually argued the case. I was in charge of logistics, things like making sure we had enough security and enough room for the press to be there because it was really a big event for a very small courtroom. But our strategy in terms of approaching what we were going to say was it was remarkable in doing our research for this case how similar the arguments being made in our case were to the arguments that had been made in the interracial marriage cases of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And so we decided to point out that we now think it was absurd. In the United States, we think it is absurd for anybody to ban an interracial couple from marrying. And we made the argument that those exact same arguments are being made today, and 50 years from now, we will also look back and say that those arguments were absurd in the context of the same-sex marriage debate. Our position is that the civil union law does not follow the mandate of the Baker versus State case, because it does not provide full marriage rights. It is essentially setting up a second-class apartheid system, essentially, if you will, that there are two classes of couples in terms of who gets marriage licenses and who gets some other kind of license. Having said that, it is a great first step for gay and lesbian couples in this state, because it gives gay and lesbian couples the full panoply of rights that any married couple gets in Vermont under Vermont state law.
What would be the legal scenario for this to come back to the state for marriage as opposed to civil union?
The Supreme Court actually retained jurisdiction in the case, which is an unusual thing for them to do. They usually make a decision and then either dismiss the case or close the case out or send it back to the trial court for further proceedings. In this case, they kept it. The litigants in our case, our plaintiffs are frankly tired. I think the state of Vermont is tired right now. And I think that the goal of both myself and our co-counsel, my co-counsel, as well as this Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force at this point, is to try to help with the ongoing education about the civil union law and to talk again about whether or not the civil union law provides the kinds of protections that gay families need. It does not allow gay couples to access U.S. federal law, and it does not necessarily provide what we call portability to other states. So if a couple gets a civil union license here in Vermont and then travels to another state, say Missouri or Texas, there's still an open question as to whether or not the civil union that they entered into in Vermont will be recognized in that other state. So that's still an open question, and we think that as time goes on, it'll become clear to all of us exactly what the shortcomings of the civil union law are, and that at that point, that's probably the point at which the Vermont Supreme Court will be looking at whether or not marriage licenses themselves, not just civil union licenses, must be granted to a same-sex couple. But I'm guessing that's a couple of years down the line.
Arguments against same-sex marriage do seem ridiculous once you've come to know couples like Sandy Cote and Bobby Whitaker, who've been together for 33 years.
Hi, I'm Sandy.
And I'm Bobby.
Can you tell us how we've come to this point in the state of Vermont?
Okay, I really believe that we've come to where we are right now because Beth Robinson and Sue Murray started the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force in 1995. They came up with the speaking points and doing the pictures and putting a personal face on this issue. And I really think that's what made it the difference here in Vermont is we were people. It was Sandy and Bobby. It's easy to discriminate against them. Impossible sometimes to discriminate against your neighbor. And I think that's what was the key here is we went out into our communities and talked to people and explained them to them who we were and what we were about.
What was that like? I mean, in the early days, you must have had some major opposition or just people who didn't really think about it or get the whole thing.
Actually, at the very beginning, it wasn't that difficult because the only people that wanted to talk to us were the people who already agreed with us. So it wasn't that difficult until the court decision came down last December 20th. And ever since then, we have been continuing to have forums around the state. But we finally got the people who were opposed to it and who were unsure about it, who were coming to the forums and were asking questions. And it was at that point in time that I think that everybody in the state started talking about it.
Do you ever feel, or did you ever feel, a little bit afraid having come out? I mean, Vermont is not a violent state, but there are some Looney Tunes here, you know?
I actually didn't come out until 1997 when I was 50 years old, and I was more scared before I came out than I have been the last 3 years. It was the most freeing feeling in the world.
And I think you're safer being out than not being out. Because our picture's been in the newspapers and everything, everybody knows we are gay, and that is a protection by itself. Our younger generation didn't even start in the closet, whereas we, most all of us, have started in the closet and come out. Mm-hmm. And that is a a hard thing to do, because you never know. The people that you think are going to embrace you are the ones that don't. Those that you think are going to deny you are the ones that embrace you. So it's a scary, it's scary with your own family. There's still the fear that you're going to be rejected and that you're going to be physically hurt. Vermont is part of America. We have had incidences in Vermont. Fortunately, we have a good hate crimes bill.
Was it very hard to get the term changed from domestic partnership to civil union? That seemed to happen pretty readily.
The Senate talked a little bit about it. There were several names that were thrown around. Domestic partnerships, they felt, had too much baggage with it and didn't really address what our relationship is. The civil union was a compromise, and it was one that we very much liked once we got used to the fact that it was going to be a civil union instead of marriage. But when you come to the table to negotiate, there are certain things that is a break point. And civil unions was one of those break points where we had to give up solemnization and ended up with a certification. So civil unions was, everybody's comfortable with it, and it's a civil union, it's not a marriage.
One of the points about a civil union is that it would not be recognized out of Vermont. What are some of the other differences between civil union and marriage?
The name, the social acceptance of it, it's separate. There's no arguing that. It also is a gateway, the gateway into 1,000 federal benefits that we're not entitled to with civil unions. That for Bobby and I is important, our Social Security benefits. We gave those up when we accepted civil unions.
What do you do to have a civil union? Do you go to a justice of the peace? Do you have a certificate? And how do you break a civil union? How do you get, quote, divorced?
It's set up completely parallel to marriage. The same people that can perform marriages as agents of the state can also perform civil unions. Clergy, justices of the peace, judges. How you get out of it is the same way as you do a divorce through the family court.
So let me come back to your experience testifying, and then we'll move on.
To me, marriage was what we were after, but it was the equality that came with the marriage. And my testimony was, I thought that we had forgot what Baker v. State was all about, and what Baker v. State was all about was my right to marry my partner, Bobby. And it didn't depend on the governor's comfort zone, my neighbor's comfort zone, that it was a matter of civil rights. We were being denied them and are going to continue to be denied them. And that's what it was really all about.
It was actually very scary because you had 2 minutes in which to tell your entire life story and make sure that it was important enough that you said exactly the right thing so that it touched their hearts and made them understand what the problems were. And mainly the points that I made were the story that happened to us. In 1997, Sandy went to the doctor and he told her that she had cancer. So she was really, really terrified about this, and she came back home and she wanted to me to talk to the doctor too. He absolutely refused to discuss anything with me because I wasn't family. Now, we'd only been together about 30 years at the time, so, you know.
And we had our medical powers of attorney, and this doctor had accepted the medical powers of attorney when we presented them to him, and he had been our doctor for 7 years. And the medical power of attorney said that when I became incapacitated, then Bobby would make all the medical decisions for me. And he wanted to hold to that. And Bobby showed them 6 documents, the medical powers of attorney on each other, the living wills, the durable powers of attorney, our wills. And these are the legal documents that we have had for over 12 years to protect each other so that in the event that something happens to us, there's no misunderstanding. But as Bobby pointed out to the judiciary committees, because it was a joint judiciary committee, both the House and the Senate, those documents were only as good as the individual that you handed them to. they could choose to go exactly the way it was written or understand. And the doctor chose to go exactly the way it was written. And those were some of the problems that Bobby and I have faced together in our 33 years, where the doctor tells you, your partner, that she has cancer and he wants to start doing treatment immediately, and you're not even allowed to be part of the discussion. The argument has always been, well, you can get all sorts of legal documents to cover these situations. And it's true, you can. They cost about $4,000. And again, you have no way to ensure that they're going to be respected and they're going to be taken with the intent that they were drawn up with. And at the time of a crisis, there's no time to have to go to court and get a judge to tell a doctor, you've got to deal with this as a family unit. So I think you need to have the protection that this civil unions bill gives us. Our opponents kept on calling it marriage, and that hurt very deeply because we had to give up marriage. Once marriage was off the table, the task force had to make the decision to continue on with civil unions or back out and go back to court.
How do you personally feel about the outcome? Because you've put so much effort into it.
It's kind of bittersweet in a way. After 30 years, I still want to get married. But it is a wonderful first step. And for families that are just starting out, it gives them things that they really need.
On September 15th this year, Sandy Cote and Bobby Whitaker will be, as they call it, civil unioned in their hometown of Manchester, Vermont. Bobby's mother and her grandparents, who will celebrate their anniversary that day, will be there. I'm Elaine Clift, reporting from Saxton's River, Vermont.
In the conclusion of Elaine Clift's look at the long road to civil unions, we'll hear from others who've played a role in the drive for same-gender marriage rights in Vermont, including a preacher.
I've always been a sucker for justice issues, and this particular issue of civil rights for same-sex couples and for gay and lesbian people and transgendered and bisexual people as well has always been sort of on my plate.
And a politician.
The women were overwhelmingly supportive of civil union. Had it been left to the male legislators, if only their votes counted, civil unions would have failed.
That's next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Chase Schulte, Brian Nunes, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, and Rex Walkner contributed program material. Thanks also to GAIN, the Gender Advocacy Information Network, and to Elaine Clift, Mary O'Grady, and Frieda Worden of WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Gill Foundation and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, by Planet Out, from designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com, visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. And please be sure to include the call letters of this station. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on Multimedia, then on Radio. For Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KSHU Huntsville, Texas, 2XX Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, WFCS New Britain, Connecticut, and more than 100 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.